Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 69, section 1, which is old single column, page 772. So, not too often that we're starting a session after such a tiny little preface with section one like this, but to recall, as I tried to stress, especially at the very ending of that little preface, is a very important foundational threefold of concepts tied to past, present, and future, relative to the beginnings of the evolution of civilization. That it begins very unconsciously, that a legacy develops. And over time, that gets established as a tradition that everyone identifies to in the present. So that legacy from the past gets established as a definitive present tradition. And then eventually, as people get more sophisticated, have more foresight, they conceive of extending that tradition forward into the future in a conscious way. I mean, obviously, unconsciously, you know, one present is followed by the next present, which is followed by the next present moment, and tradition marches on. But that tradition is going to be evolving. But if at a given point you decide, oh, this isn't just the present moment of evolutionary tradition, this is something that should be thought of as tied to eternity and should be set in stone and we should go with it into the future in a, you know, relatively changeless fashion. And that's when you turn that tradition into a convention. So legacy, tradition, convention. And that's important as we begin a paper about institutions, because that's what institutions represent, is basically the substance, if you will, of convention. Institutions are conventionalized facts. So, it takes a while to get to the point where you have definitive institutions. It requires a measure of sophistication of the people, where there's something that foresight is has a role in, so that the concept of convention can be in play. All right, so it starts out with this first section. See by the title, it's just giving you some foundational elements about this issue of human institutions. And as you can glance down, you can see that they're going to introduce institutions in this threefold mode of self-maintenance, self-perpetuation, self-gratification. Which is a theme that runs throughout these civilizational papers of putting things in a rough categorization under those headings. These are issues related to self-maintenance. These are issues related to self-gratification, etc. There's an very interesting drone tone, if you will, a thread of consistency that runs through these three groups that we'll discover here as we once we get to their brief little statements of all three. But let's start out and see what they say in the little preface of the list of three there.
Section one, basic human institutions. All human institutions minister to some social need, past or present. Notwithstanding that their overdevelopment unfailingly detracts from the worthwhileness of the individual, in that personality is overshadowed and initiative is diminished. Man should control his institutions rather than permit himself to be dominated by these creations of advancing civilization.
Okay, so what do we have there to begin with? You see how they start out there, pointing out what I was saying. They're minister to some social need, past or present. And so you're not really projecting forward into the future initially. And they want to, you think about what things they want to put up right up front. They immediately want to remind you that all good things taken to extreme become bad. Okay. Notwithstanding that their overdevelopment unfailingly detracts from the worthwhileness of the individual. Okay. And you can think, we often talk about this, and you can, you should always be thinking about how the current cultural norms, often have this bias to unity consciousness, so that the individual is getting de-emphasized. Collectivist ideas where, if you give any notice to the individual, you make sure that they're all wearing the same gray outfit, as it were, right? That no individual sticking up above the rest, that there's this uniformity of individuality, which you're fooling yourself as being unity. Poor man's unity, that uniformity. Besides just the basic fact of, we know, because we talk about it all the time, that you must have definitive individuality and definitive unity so that you have the differential and there can be a super additive consequence. That's what you're looking for to power evolution, is those differentials. But notice the point that they're bringing in, besides that sort of basic physics of it, what about how it impacts the individuality of individuals? In that personality is overshadowed and initiative is diminished. Right? I occasionally bring this up, is that's the most problematic aspect of that de-individuation of the social character, is that there's no place for personality in an ever greater bias to unity. Personality is absolutely unique. It's predicated on definitive individuality. Unity has no personality. You're going to lose, as they say, they're literally in the initiative, that personality coming from the Father, the initiator, and you being a son of that Father, being able to initiate in kind with that gift, being a lesser initiator, or his initiating of reality flowing through you, but also just originality, that is obviously absent in that picture of uniformity that I was painting a minute ago. You lose originality, that comes from personality. Everything just becomes this, washed out phenomenon, where in terms of societal things, everyone is a social automaton. Okay. And so they want to stress that, that's the, that's their big point of why good things taken to extreme become bad. The badness is the loss of any means for personality to manifest. With its originality and initiative, genuine initiative, genuine creativity. Not mere inventiveness of mind, but creativity of spirit personality. All right. Laying down that man should control his institutions rather than permit himself to be dominated by these creations. It's like, well, how could that happen? Remember, if you take what's in the external world and drag it in and up, and give it the seats of honor in your inner life, falsely exalt that passing evolutionary state and give it this existentialized place, in the temple within, right? That domain above, the upper domain, dominates the lower domain. That's just what it does by nature. So whatever is up there is dominant, whether it's worthy of that being dominant or not. There's danger. There's individual danger. And then, of course, that unfortunate individual state gets socialized outward, and the whole civilization gets drugged down. So you have this this unfortunate, it sloshes in and then sloshes back out again in a benighted state. Okay, so that's just interesting to note that they kind of put the warnings right up front. And then they get to, then they just get to the basics. But they clearly want us to keep those things in mind as we go forward with the whole paper, avoid these tendencies to think simplistically about institutions. There's a lot of people that just think all institutions are bad by definition. And it's like, no, they all have their place, but you need to stay in charge. Make sure that you don't get, unfortunately, underneath these institutions. Did you have something? Okay. All right. So let's get this first one here.
Human institutions are three general classes. One, the institutions of self-maintenance. These institutions embrace those practices growing out of food hunger and its associated instincts of self-preservation. They include industry, property, war for gain, and all the regulative machinery of society. Sooner or later, the fear instinct fosters the establishment of these institutions of survival by means of taboo, convention, and religious sanction. But fear, ignorance, and superstition have played a prominent part in the early origin and subsequent development of all human institutions.
Okay, so the fact that, yes, you can take all institutions to an extreme where they become bad, but that, flip that back. I mean, there's a goodness to institutions, at least, in some very initial state, even the most limited institution, can have a role to get things started. And that's predicated on the fact, that goodness is predicated on fear, ignorance, and superstition. So just think about what's between the lines there. Your first thought is, fear, ignorance, and superstition, those are innately bad things. No, the universe is a vast conspiracy. The universe can do something good with everything. And if you couldn't do anything, if the supreme mind couldn't do something good with fear or ignorance or superstition, fear, ignorance, and superstition wouldn't exist. Right? So they have their place in getting things started. It's not a sign that you are a child of the iniquitous one, that the foundation of your animal nature is fear. Right? God made you that way, not some evil being. You know, or some evil being didn't step in and reform you in that unfortunate way. No. God made your zeroth level of meaning, the level of fear, because it's the best way to start you out. There is no better way to start beings like us, to launch such beings into reality.
I was just thinking how a lot of social science theories are based on the assumption that there's something wrong with people, innately wrong with people, that has to be corrected.
Yeah.
Our basic nature is sound.
Yeah, the foundation is sound. You just need to grow. Children of God are good, but all good things taken to extreme become bad. If you freeze that child state for too long, it flips around and becomes a bad thing. You know, that you're not maturing through the difficulties of adolescence and becoming an adult of God. Think about how you could easily turn the revelation that you're a child of God into an unfortunate convention, see? It's like, and we got to make sure that we keep ourselves as children of God forever. You know, if you think about it, there's a parable about that. Something about burying something in the ground and not touching it until the master returns. Right? Don't bury your child of God nature in the ground like that. You have to invest it and it needs to grow. Okay. All right, so you see that a lot of this first paragraph is not so much about the institution of self-maintenance, but bringing in this whole bit about the fear foundation and such issues. Saying that it has to do with these institutions of self-maintenance, and saying, well, actually, it has to do with all the institutions. It's like, well, why didn't they put it up there in the preface before number one? If it's really about all of them, well, look at these institutions of self-maintenance. Look at the foundational facts that are in play, right? Food hunger, for instance, right? You know, the nutrition epic, that first developmental epic. Food hunger and its associative instincts of self-preservation. And you notice it's preservation, not conservation, but preservation. Right? Because we're just talking about, I mean, you don't want to preserve your experiential nature. That needs to grow. Right? And you're conserving it in, you know, as you grow in forward into the future. But you do want to preserve your existential nature. You need to exist first. Right? Your existence has to be preserved. Right? So that's another reason why conservation movements get unfortunately, you know, downgraded into preservation movements. See, it's that existential bias again coming in. Father parent, no mother parent in your worldview, and you slip into preservation mode, see, which is only appropriate when you're thinking about something existential, like is there a self or not? Right? Now that's what we're talking about. Self-preservation is about the existence or non-existence of a self. Right? And so just, you know, think about, reflect on their, how they word these statements. Why is it self-preservation? Why is that appropriate? So now they give some definitive examples. So this whole bit of keeping things going here, this self-maintenance, industry, property, war for gain, right? Like maybe the war gains a big pile of food. That, in that sense, anything that that the war would gain that would, you know, help with this maintaining yourself. You know, a handy salt mine, you know, or something. You're going to die without salt, or you know, whatever it might be. And then, you know, all the regulative machinery of society. You know, as we're in this very unfortunately complex civilization now, just, you know, totally bogged down with over-regulation, you know, there's a tendency to conclude that regulation is innately bad. You know, they're reminding you, no, there must be some regulation. You know, some laws of social order. Right? But all good things taken to extreme become bad. Yeah, so that's where that fits in. Yeah, it's a very foundational thing that there's regulations. It's an institution, the institution of regulations. Yeah, the regulatory institution is there for this very foundational issue of self-maintenance. Yeah, so that's obviously one of the ways it could get out of control if you start thinking that it's for dealing with the higher issues. Like, no, it's for this foundational stuff. You know, when you start using it to try to somehow manipulate, you know, in a totalitarian fashion, the details in the penthouse of the structure of civilization, then it's going to be a problem.
Like trying to force people to be good.
Right. Right. We all know, right, you're trying to regulate, you know, morality into existence, for instance. No, you're trying to regulate self-maintenance, you know, like literally making sure that all the selves don't die of starvation or something, right? Yeah. Okay, so if you reflect on it, there's a lot of basic facts you can mine here in developing a better science of government, for instance. Knowing where the various elements are properly, you know, what sphere they properly should exist in. You know, so you notice they even kind of said it that way. They include industry, right? You have this sphere of institutions of self-maintenance, and what ones are inside that? Okay, not just this is an institution that, you know, self-maintenance issues touch upon that, but this is, you know, this is very definitively involved in self-maintenance. These, you know, those ones that they say are included like that. All right. What do they say about the next group here? Oh, yeah, got something in the webinar? Okay.
Yeah, real quick. David Jones wonders if you know about human source work for this section of paper.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's William Graham Sumner is, you know, is the basic human source for a lot of the basic template that the Revelators are building upon for the evolution of civilization and all kinds of related issues. You have, you know, where you're dealing with anthropological stuff like the history of the marriage institution, you know, and the marriage and family papers and home institution. And yeah, William Graham Sumner is a big individual in all that, you know, self-maintenance, self-perpetuation, self-gratification. There's a lot of this stuff that, you know, one of the last individuals to live that was had enough mindful integrity to be potentially used as a human source work for a revelation, William Graham Sumner, is used extensively. Again, you got to go back to the beginning of the 20th century before the Endarkenment just completely corrupted our scholars and made them just completely unusable as a human source work. Right? There's no truth flowing through their works that you can play off of. You know, for instance, you know, just to, you know, as long as we bring this up, one of the things you can do with William Graham Sumner is, he's got topics in a certain order. And the revelators say, well, no, put them in this order instead. You know, just, you know, if you want to get into the details of that, of the parallel to the, you know, that human source, you know, note things like that. Those are very important. The revelators are saying, if you put them in this order instead, the truth flows through the facts better. In that other order, it has blockages. You know, there's all kinds of details like that that you can think about that, in terms of the mastery of the construct of what we're reading here. Okay, so yeah, the next block here.
Two, the institutions of self-perpetuation. These are the establishments of society growing out of sex hunger, maternal instinct, and the higher tender emotions of the race. They embrace the social safeguards of the home and the school, of family life, education, ethics, and religion. They include marriage customs, war for defense, and home building.
Okay, so self-perpetuation in contrast to self-maintenance. And you know, as you can see, foundationally, you know, in self-perpetuation is procreation. Okay, that fundamental issue. You know, so not just making sure that this self doesn't die, but you get two of these selves of opposite gender together and produce a super additive consequence. Okay, so and here you see very directly, you know, them pointing out the that foundational differential between men and women. You have maternal instinct on the one side, but you don't have paternal instinct on the other side. You have sex hunger. Sex hunger and maternal instinct are the two foundational elements. But notice what they say. And the higher tender emotions of the races. One of the most foundational ones of those higher tender emotions of the races is parental instinct. Remember this came up before when they brought up maternal instinct and the sex hunger. There is a parental instinct, but see, that's a higher tender emotion of the races. And you see that playing out. Not only do you have family life, but school, right? You know, before you have literally, you know, government-run schools, say, right? The parents educate the children. That's part of the parental instinct, that there is education. Right? I mean, we see that in even animals, right? Animal parents educating animal children. Right? That's a part of the parental instinct. So you can see that, that's one of the easiest ways to appreciate why some of these institutions that they're mentioning are in this block. It's because of the parental instinct. Which males and females have in common. Very much equal quantity and quality of parental instinct. But that's built upon a very non-equal foundation of sex hunger and maternal instinct. All right, now notice the complexity. They have two lists in this one. They've got the include list like they did in the previous one. They include marriage customs, war for defense, and home building. So things that are very, you know, definitively of this flavor. But then broader issues that you definitely, the concept of self-perpetuation certainly has a significant relationship to these things, but also a lot with others. Right? So they don't say include, they say embrace. Yeah. The arms are grabbing onto these issues, but not totally, sort of totally within that sphere. So just those subtleties like that of differentiating between embraced institutions and included institutions. You see, they're bringing in here. Notice with the embracing, it's the whole. It's not literally just the home, but in the context of social safeguards. Because remember, this is the whole basic issue of self-perpetuation. Take something like ethics. See, that doesn't begin in some grand group scope. Right? That begins with the family. And it's predicated on that parental instinct. Right? That you're going to set up an ethics relative to your children. And then it expands from that foundation out into a greater culture. All right, let's see. You got something there? Yep.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the safeguard, social safeguard, seems real strong to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mormons, I don't know, and other groups too, not just them.
Yeah.
I'm just really grateful that they have so much strength because of their family and their home and their school.
Sure.
It's giving them a real strength right now for morals, ethics.
Right, for something to be built upon that foundation. Again, without a foundation, you can't build anything. And so you're seeing in these two, you have sort of individual safeguards, and you have social safeguards. You have these foundational facts of individuality and of the nuclear social unit of the family. And obviously, you can't have a family if individuals die of starvation. So you see how it builds, but you have an individual and a collective foundation. Are foundational elements for individuals and collectives. Okay? And I was just about to say, before I went to the third group here, we're noticing something interesting. There's a lot of difference between these two blocks, but there's something that's the same. War. Yeah, it's war for gain on the one hand and war for defense on the other hand, but war. The value of war is great enough that it actually spans two groups of institutions. Right? So, long before we get to this section is about the social value of war, you see it right here. It's just very striking. War has a lot of value in it, but all good things taken to extreme become bad, and it's an issue of at what point do you begin to cross that threshold to where war becomes a net negative instead of this very seemingly near universal positive to begin with. The answer is fundamentally as you're going and you're definitively into nation state status, leaving tribalism behind, and it is when war begins to have diminishing returns, net diminishing returns.
No, we're really studying things that are outside, but inevitably I always try to apply them to myself. So. Mm-hmm. It's interesting which one of these I have a preference for personally. It's like we have a bias, I think, for one of these.
like my bias is towards the self-maintenance, not so much the self-perpetuation. Yeah, I've got a personal bias here.
Uh-huh.
My wife probably favors more the personal self-perpetuation,
yeah,
which causes a tension in our relationship.
Yeah, of course, to be precise, it's not a personal bias. Probably just foundationally a bias of temperament.
That's right.
A temperamental bias. But again, you may have used your personality to more absolutize, existentialize those initial self differences. And then it does become a personal issue, and very difficult to change. So you've got this white knuckle grip on it. Okay. So what do they give us here for the third group?
We get it.
Oh, quite another question. I'm sorry.
It's a brief one from John Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
Would you associate the higher tender emotions with the higher adjutants?
Yes and no. I mean, the more immediate way to think about the levels that are higher here is not the seven adjutants stacked up, in a building of seven stories, but the levels of meaning. Right? And you should be able to figure that out, because what does it say? Higher tender emotions? Right. Getting up from the level of the flesh to the level of the feelings. Yeah, so it's an issue when you start to go out of the moment and into more long-term meaning. Right? And, like educating your children. See, there's a longer-term perspective in play there. It's not just something you're doing for the sake of the moment. So yes, you're bringing in adjutants 4, 5, 6 above 1, 2, 3. Yes, but more precisely, it's the levels of meaning that you're moving up. Yeah. The tricky thing is to have something besides the first and second levels of meaning, and we're seeing here, because if it's not obvious. Self-gratification doesn't give you the third level of meaning, and and then it's all just temple within beyond that. All right.
3, the institutions of self-gratification. These are the practices growing out of vanity proclivities and pride emotions, and they embrace customs in dress and personal adornment, social usages, war for glory, dancing, amusement, games, and other phases of sensual gratification. But civilization has never evolved distinctive institutions of self-gratification.
Okay, that's just the way they worded that final sentence. Distinctive institutions. Oh, that's what the include was about, because you notice here we just have embrace. So in the first one we had include, and the second one we had include and embrace, and here we have just embrace. Okay, so self-gratification, is an element in these various things they're bringing up here. But at least at the back at the beginning of the 20th century, civilization had never evolved distinctive institutions of self-gratification. And you think about over the course of the 20th century, moving into the 21st, that's changed some. We now have some pretty sophisticated institutions that developed that are really for pretty much nothing but self-gratification. You have professional athletes now. Way back when, you didn't have professional athletes, right? You have, these very sophisticated, the whole amusement park industry and cruise ship industries and all this sort of stuff, right? So you know, that's not as definitive, now as it was back at the beginning of the 20th century when they were writing this. Okay, and from the way they say this, it's like, well, that must have some positiveness to it. Yes, but it can quickly become too much. You know, we are just becoming awash in pleasure mania, right? To the point that you're so fixated on pleasure, you literally starve to death. to become self-destructive. Just note that, when you see like amusement there in games, it's like, well, yeah, you're going, what do you mean, distinctive institutions, amusement and games? Yeah, remember, this was back at the beginning of the 20th century that they were saying that. There's a lot more spiritual energy in play now, which has these immature manifestations of, having some spiritual energy juicing your mind can make pleasure all the more pleasurable and tending to self-absorption in that regard. See? It's all about you and your experiences. And you notice even pride, the word pride came into play here again in this block. So you've got, see, just right there, you see the spiritual energization of the mind that they're reminding you of. For those who are familiar with this, this was coming, but now we see it directly, war again. Only now is war for glory. So yes, when all is said and done with some of these basic examples of institutions in all three modes here, there's a drone tone. There's a universal positive in founding these three domains of institutions. War. I mean, look at the social value of war that you see right there. That's why war is natural. I mean, it's needed universally to get the whole civilizational, institutionalized civilizational phenomenon going. Isn't that an interesting little point that they begin with here? Certainly challenges war. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. To see how out of historical contextual recognition that statement is, and how that historical recognition is important, because it's not just us on the planet. Our history is also on the planet right now. There's people in every developmental stage that we went through ages ago, all the way back to the beginning. Right? And if you forget that, and think, well, let's just universalize us, let's pretend everyone on the planet is like us, that's going to have great problems. War is indispensable in every way, shape, and form for a lot of people on the planet right now still. Doesn't matter if it's talking about self-maintenance, self-perpetuation, or a little bit of pleasure in life with self-gratification. You literally need it as an outlet, for glory. That absence of exciting stuff is going to have produce very caustic societal ills, if there isn't that outlet. There's a lot of guys that war is just so exciting, right? And if you short circuit that, well, this could be a problematic proclivity, you know, if you put it in a confined space. Yeah. Yes, it becomes a pressure cooker, right, that blows at some point in a small space. See, so these are very difficult facts. To face these facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Few things are as difficult for us to think about objectively now with our spiritual energization than war. To see any positive in that. And yet also recognize the definitive negativeness of it in us ever getting to advancing civilization. And you're never going to get to advancing civilization if you're still beset by war. So, yeah. Okay. So that's kind of a surprise that comes out of that issue of war. All right, what else is the final little statement here in section one?
These three groups of social practice are intimately interrelated and minutely interdependent, the one upon the other. On Urantia, they represent a complex organization which functions as a single social mechanism.
Okay, so when all is said and done, they want to leave you with, now, but don't get simple-minded about this. They were hinting at that, with the difference between include and embrace already. Okay. If you pick that up, you already basically knew what they, if you had properly interpreted that, you already recognized what they're bringing up here in this final paragraph. But they wanted to stress it, just in case that wasn't apparent to you, that you don't want to think simplistically about this. I mean, it's all a complex single social mechanism when all is said and done. And requires a lot of wisdom to start monkeying with it, which of course is non-existent right now. And everyone wants to monkey with it, that single social mechanism, because they don't see it as a single social mechanism. They say it is a whole bunch of independent mechanisms, and it's like, well, we can do all kinds of radical things with this little mechanism here, and that has no consequences. No, there is no such. It's apparently an independent mechanism, but it isn't really. It's really a part of a whole. And that's just kind of inescapable when humans are involved, because no matter how ignorant humans are of holistic consciousness, they have it. It's innate in what we do. It ends up being an organism, not a collection of parts. And you have to have the wisdom of the whole organism before you start monkeying with any one part, because it has consequences everywhere else. Okay, so that's the basic framework that they wanted to give us, and now they just start into the evolutionary scenario and give us the beginnings of things. Remember, think about how as you're moving forward, you know, there must be some parallel with those developmental epochs as you start thinking in, you know, along a historical line. You know, you're starting with the nutrition epoch and moving into the security age and then getting into the material comfort era. All right, what do they say here?
Section 2, the dawn of industry. Primitive industry slowly grew up as an insurance against the terrors of famine. Early in his existence, man began to draw lessons from some of the animals that, during a harvest of plenty, stored up food against the days of scarcity.
Okay, so just starting with that little element, and animals, see, helped out, watching animals, squirrels storing stuff up or whatever, helped us to sort of prime the pump of foresight, to recognize this and begin to institutionalize what we've recognized there. And you see how they, so here, like I said, nutrition epic, you see very much in the beginning here. But you notice they say terrors of famine. And that reminds you again of why they put the whole fear thing there in that block with number, you know, that first block with the institutions of self-maintenance. That very foundational terror of famine that mankind had, you know, very shortly down the road, experiential road from Andon and Fonda. You had enough people that you had the first famines, and it was, you know, just a horrendous experience, you know, gut-wrenching experience. You know, think about initially there's so few people to begin with, and everyone knows that, right? They basically know every human that's alive, right? Personally. And then in comes famine, and, you know, and all of your friends and relatives, right, that you know very intimately died. So this terror of famine got set in place very definitively to begin with, and powered how things got started. But as they're stressing there, you know, it's, you know, you are, even though you are observing animals and kind of picking up on that, it's nonetheless an internal, personal foresight that is the predicate for setting up institutions in this regard, institutionalizing the storing up of food.
Okay? It's not instinctual.
Yeah, it's not adjutant, it's human. And it's not merely adjutant. Yes, it's through the adjutants that everything works. I mean, your mind is always the means, right, for everything. It answers, you know, many how questions. But remember, there's always a why question. Okay? There are some things that are totally within the mind, and the why, answer to the why question is the mind. But not everything, you know. Not every why question. Sometimes you got to go above the spirit and personality to understand why something is there, not just how it, you know, what the means for it is. You know, there's the will and there's the way. Okay? All right. So that's just a little paragraph to start us out. That's the foundation. Okay. Then what?
Before the dawn of early frugality and primitive industry, the lot of the average tribe was one of destitution and real suffering. Early man had to compete with the whole animal world for his food. Competition gravity ever pulls man down toward the beast level. Poverty is his natural and tyrannical estate. Wealth is not a natural gift. It results from labor, knowledge, and organization.
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously not going to go into all of the ramifications and ideologies about that. I mean, they just blew up a whole bunch of ideologies there in one little paragraph. But you know, notice the thing that should have caught your attention right to begin with before you got into the details to understand. It said real suffering, you noticed. You're going, whoa, real suffering? Do they mean real? Yes, they do. Right, as they explain, because these things tend to drag you down to just the fancy animal state of mind. That has a real consequence. You know, your personal nature is suffered. Right? There's just no way to be personal in the face of such an assault on you.
We have historical examples of that, yeah. Even in the Bible. Jerusalem was under siege.
Right.
Tells of people eating their children.
Yeah. Right. So, it can get pretty beast level, as they say.
Highest people of the time.
Yes. Right. Yeah. See, I'm using that gravity. You know. Right. Because as we saw. Groups, any sort of a group phenomenon is predicated on individuals, you know, and if the more drags down, the more you're going to lose any sort of a group, and it's all going to boil down to just you as an individual. and forget about any group ethics. So again, you see them emphasizing what they brought up the front, this whole bit about, if that foundation isn't solid, you can forget about any higher human manifestations. It just gets short-circuited right then and there, and that's it. And it's just going to be fancy animal stuff, and probably not even very fancy, but very... very crude, beastie coarse, animal stuff. In this life, perforce you serve two masters. No amount of wishful thinking is going to change the fact that there's that material gravity that will drag you down if you short-circuit any balancing spiritual gravity. And, you can do that internally, or it just can be done to you brutally externally. You're just pounded out of your humanity by the environment. And then the stuff that's kind of more consequential in terms of philosophy there at the end, wealth is not a natural gift. To just state that. War might be natural, but wealth isn't. Wealth is artificial, right? It's unnatural. It results from humans. Humans produce wealth. So just think about how problematic it is if you decide that wealth is innately evil. all right, see?
Beastly.
Right. It's like, no, it's a fundamental foundation of human, the fruits of humanity, of being human. The degree to which there's no wealth is the degree to which there's just not humans there. They're just animals, effectively. But like we said, it may be just because the environment has pounded them down to that, but nonetheless, all said and done, it's just basically an animal phenomenon. There's no wealth. So if you want to be a bunch of animals, outlaw wealth. And they're going to get to this labor thing here. And the knowledge of science there, and organization. And I see that's that, that human quality of encompassing, and thinking of things in terms of a system, like we were talking about that with that single social mechanism, right? That there's this holistic imposition where you establish a coordination, not just associations. You have this systematized phenomenon, this encompassed this phenomenon. There's a wholeness within which the parts exist. Okay, organization, organism. All right, so that's again the human influence. All right, see what they say here.
Primitive man was not slow to recognize the advantages of association. Association led to organization. And the first result of organization was division of labor, with its immediate saving of time and materials. These specializations of labor arose by adaptation to pressure, pursuing the paths of lessened resistance. Primitive savages never did any real work cheerfully or willingly. With them, conformity was due to the coercion of necessity.
See, again, real work. Right? Whether it's, we're talking about the doings of persons, right? Instead of just fancy animals. So hence the appropriateness of saying willingly there. Right? The will has to be involved. Okay, right at the beginning, you see what I was just saying. Right? You have just mere association, but then you get systematized, right, into a coordination, into an organization. And I, you know, it's like an organism, you know, where you have differentiation of cells. Right? The cells are specialized. This is a skin cell. This is a heart cell. Right? This is a brain cell, etc. Right? So just as you see that, you know, in a biologic organism, right? You see that in the social organism, the organization of the society.
Basic one, of course, would be sexual.
You're jumping ahead to section three. But exactly.
Yeah.
Right, you're recognizing the law, you know, basic logic of that, you know, which we get to in section three. You know, the whole question of, you know, what's the predicate for specialization? That's what section three is about. You notice the importance of the path of least resistance, right? Pursuing the paths of lessened resistance. Right? That's a basic, inescapable fact of material. And in this life, perforce, we serve two masters. You can't somehow, don't think that that's, you know, any sort of a search for the path of least resistance is somehow evil, say, right, or whatever. No, it's an inescapable part. You want to conform to the laws of matter. They follow that law of minimization of action. We quickly began to recognize that and set ourselves up to conform to that instead of fighting against the natural laws of material phenomena. And that brought in some pleasure to life. Began to free up some time that wasn't there before. But you have to fight against doing anything, sophisticated. You have to bring in personal nature. And there's effort, struggle, conflict with your animal nature, right? See? That effort, struggle, conflict sequence. And getting over, I don't want to do that, you know. I want to just be lazy like I am naturally. But it starts out like, when we get to the indispensables, right? We always talk about those initial four indispensables or cal prods, slavery, war, social classes, profit motive, especially the first two. Right, that with them conformity was due to the coercion of necessity. So it starts out very primitive, but you do notice they stressed it's primitive, savage is, they're talking about here. Not even the improved state of barbarians, but the most primitive state of savages. But there, the important thing there in terms of besides the basic facts is that truth of that you start with individuals and then you have super additive consequence of an association. Of course, that means there had to have been some unity there, had to have been some spirit brought in by humans, right, to get that associative consequence. But then you begin to bring in the harmonization influence of that personality and producing a coordinated phenomenon and organization. Okay.
Primitive man disliked hard work, and he would not hurry unless confronted by grave danger. The time element in labor, the idea of doing a given task within a certain time limit, is entirely a modern notion. The ancients were never rushed. It was the double demands of the intense struggle for existence and the ever-advancing standards of living that drove the naturally inactive races of early man into avenues of industry.
So let's think about that. Let me think about that. The essence in that final part first. Remember, I told you, keep in mind as you're reading all of this, those three developmental epochs: the nutrition epoch, the security age, the material comfort era. See, it came up there. See, ever-advancing standards of living. And so as you start to get into the material comfort era, that's important. See, to drive man who's naturally inactive, right, into avenues of industry. So you got, this whole bit of that we struggle with now. It's like our culture is so insanely complicated, and we're trying to have this elaborate standard of living. You know, it has all these details, all these I's that you have to dot and T's you have to cross, in order to be, up with the times, and accepted by your peers. And it starts to strike you as just bad. No, it's a good thing that's been taken to an extreme. Here you see its goodness in the early stages. Right? We need to be coerced a little bit by, okay, I gotta have these thingies, or I can't even invite someone over to my house if I don't have one of those thingies. They'll just never accept me as an appropriate social host. So you do what you have to do to be able to afford those thingies, right? Yeah, that's what we're talking about here. But it gets industry going. It starts to get a sophisticated, more human quality phenomenon with this, all the organization that's needed. You begin to manifest what you're given by grace as an organism out into the external world as an organization of these socialized organisms.
Yep. A very short amount of time from being when I was a child, a young child, until now, many good things have come from that struggle for existence coupled with those, I don't know why they use ever advancing. That's a
it's just we're hardwired to want to at least be able to convince ourselves that we're progressing, and we have very foolish expressions of this, how we satisfy ourselves. Well, we have more regulations this year than we did last year, so we've progressed. We have very simplistic quantitative, for instance, measures that we deem to be progress. It's like, so because we're hardwired like that, there's always, it's ever advancing. We're always changing and adding but we don't have a lot of wisdom about that. That's an appropriate tendency, but it needs to be in a context, so that there's a system, and you don't just have all of these parts that you're quote-unquote advancing off on, random tangents every which direction, and losing this, any sort of a wholeness to it. Okay, but we're just, the very fact, the simplest way to, why are we hardwired that way? We have connection to spirit. Spirit has a potential innately in it. If spirit touches mind, that potential gets actualized in the mind. What's that potential? Progressibility, right? It will actualize. But it's up to you to control that actualization of that potential. Whether or not it serves you or us well or not, that actualization of that potential. But actualize it will. You're going to do some. You're going to have some sort of an actualization that you deem to be progress. And it says there's true and false, you know, to everything. And
they sure make it inescapable about what your nature is. I mean, they've used nature, natural, all throughout this to try to help you. This is where you're naturally at.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that separates you from just nature.
Yeah, like that first one. It's natural for you to not get off your fat you-know-what unless you're in grave danger. You know, you'll wait to the last minute to escape the fire. And sometimes you've waited a couple minutes too long. And then you don't escape the fire. But see, that's the natural tendency. See, there's no foresight, you know, no wisdom, insight, and foresight in play. Right? And so you get caught off guard by events. And it just, you know, that's your natural state. And you have to challenge yourself to do the unnatural thing and move before there's literally grave danger. Before, you know, remember grave meaning, you know, heavy, weighty, you know. Before it gets to such a mass bearing down on you that it, you know, if it hits you, it crushes you.
One of the wildfires outside of Denver, I remember reading the story of this elder, well, probably my age, man and woman had gotten in the car and were ready to leave. When he went back in the house to get something and never came out. And
yeah.
She survived, but he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, and the differentials of what appears grave to one doesn't appear grave to another, and, you know, so one moves and the other doesn't, and those sorts of things, yeah. But yeah, and that whole bit, you know, that we're so locked into, you know, being slaves to the clock. You know, to the second hand even, you know, that's an entirely modern notion, you know, of doing something in a given span of time. You know, there's nothing natural about that, you know, which should be obvious if you reflect at all. I mean, when you feel that tension inside, why do I have to do it in the next hour, you know? Right, that's that tension between your, you know, personal, your spiritual nature and your basic material foundation have that tension.
Interesting they call it a deadline. It's more grave that way.
Yeah, yeah. Eh? No. Yeah. Trying to impose grave danger upon you by calling it a deadline.
Yes. Get this
done. Yes. It'll just be a complete calamity if it's not done, you know. Yes, yeah.
I'll shoot myself if I don't get this.
Yeah, and then people, you know, it becomes a taboo, right, to not do it, you know, in a lot of time. And you literally commit suicide because you're so, you know, distressed by, you know, failing to meet this demand of society.
Or you get depressed.
Yeah, you know, or depressed. Or
you know. You're so stressed as if you were going to die.
Yeah.
However, you're not really going to die, but you just have stress and anxiety issues.
You probably have enough stress to take a little bit of time off your life. Maybe you won't literally die, but you'll probably shorten your lifespan.
I got a prescription for that.
Yes, comfortably numb. is there something on the webinar?
Yeah. David Jones is asking, how do you think the revelators are defining modern notion in terms of time span? Now, back in history.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, don't think of a given, you know, calendar year. You know, it depends upon the civilization, depends on the society. You know, we still have a lot of people on the planet that, you know, unless the colonialists impose a time notion on them. I mean, there's nothing in anything, you know, in their mores has any time notion in it. You know, they just, you know, They might want to have a meeting, but they get together when they get together. You know, it's just completely meaningless to them to say the meeting's at 9 o'clock.
The original notion was seasons and when agricultural things had to happen.
Yeah. Right. And again, you see how naturally there was some stimulus. You know, if you were going to keep from starving to death, you had to have a little bit of sense of the seasons and so it slowly starts, right? But like I said, getting to the point where literally you're enslaving yourself to the second hand, let alone the minute hand or the hour hand, but literally, there's, I have 5 seconds of the broadcast left, and I'm going to put these, handful of words into those 5 seconds, where you're literally forcing yourself into such, lockstep,
A lot of it's cultural priorities. Mm-hmm. Also, if something's going on with your family or your neighbor, your close friends, if you have a meeting, your close friends and your family are far more important than some meeting with some business guy. And so you would have your priorities in order and take care of your family first. And when your family is adequately taken care of, then you might get around to stop and by talking to these business people. But there are cultures that, there's all sorts of different reasons.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's an insult if you show up on time, honestly.
Yeah.
You really don't want to do that because you're the least and you're far more important than showing up on time.
Right. But again, that's just kind of pointing out what I was saying. We have this broad bell curve of civilization on the planet. And, a lot of this stuff that might, on its face appear to be talking about some ancient history thing, but it really, there isn't anything that you can read that's so ancient that it isn't currently existent on this planet. Right? I mean, even the most primitive of things are still a present and not a past for some people. It wasn't that long ago, you still literally had people in the Stone Age because they'd never been exposed to anything outside of the Stone Age. They were an untouched people. So besides kind of understanding your nature, where you came from, and these sorts of things, it's important when you start to think about the world and the complexity of handling the world and what you have to recognize is just the way they are, and it's very inappropriate to be forcing them ahead of their time, to be bringing a lot of temporal, lockstep into their culture. Let's see, did we get everything there? Let's see. Notice it's not only grave, but they are saying danger there. We were talking about real work and real suffering. So they keep playing that in, that there are these issues of your human animal differential. Let's see, anything else that we didn't bring out there? I think we got everything there. Let's go to the next one. Yeah.
Labor, the efforts of design, distinguishes man from the beast, whose exertions are largely instinctive. The necessity for labor is man's paramount blessing. The prince's staff all worked. They did much to ennoble physical labor on Urantia. Adam was a gardener. The God of the Hebrews labored. He was the creator and upholder of all things. The Hebrews were the first tribe to put a supreme premium on industry. They were the first people to decree that he who does not work shall not eat. But many of the religions of the world reverted to the early ideal of idleness. Jupiter was a reveler, and Buddha became a reflective devotee of leisure.
So again, the moment that you stop consciously challenging the material gravity, drags it back down, and that very material fact will get called spiritual. Yeah, when all you have is material, but you want, you know, you can't help but want to call some part of what's in front of you spiritual. You'll use some criterion to say, well, this is not just material, this is spiritual. You know, in some way, this is fancy matter.
You can tell he's spiritual because he doesn't do anything.
Yes. Right, because he's a lazy blob of, material gravity phenomena.
We'll call him Jupiter.
And between the lines, just, reveler. Oh, that self-gratification thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, that's the tricky thing about self-gratification, how, it's going to, again, short-circuit your human nature, and it's all about you as a fancy animal and your experiences. One of the biggies there is, notice that they decided that they should definitively define what they want you to think of when you see the word labor in the revelation, okay? That it's not just another word for effort, okay? But it's a human word. Animals can't labor, at least not in and of themselves. You know, humans can impose themselves on animals, right? and kind of bring them into the design sphere there, okay? But see how they want to differentiate that. That labor is going to be a word that indicates the efforts of design. Okay. So that, it's innately ennobled. It's innately a human fact. And then you can understand, why the prince's staff all worked, etc. Yeah. Ennobling, like I said, physical labor. Just as they're doing by the definition, making it a human word. The beast can exert, right? And you notice there are largely instinctive. It's like, well, what do you mean, largely? Why doesn't it just say are, entirely instinctive? Like I just said, I mean, humans can impose themselves on animals, way they train them or, whatnot. Okay, and then there's a transference of your will into that energy system, just as my hand can be a manifestation of the will of my personality as a downstepped expression, right? I mean, I can downstep that out into animals and whatnot too. Right? My purposing can be manifesting through animals or through my material non-living constructs. Okay, but that's why it has that qualifier of largely. If they're not domesticated in any way, and then it's totally instinctive. So efforts of design. Thinking about that humanness of design. Examples of that we recognize from the Old Testament about the Hebrews. You see, they're pointing out where that's coming from. And then, of course, there's that biggie that they throw in there. They were the first people to decree that he who does not work shall not eat. Now, it's important to take a little aside right here and to be looking at seeing the words of that quote-unquote there very precisely. If you remember, there's a word that's different there than what you have up in, what paper is the ordination of the 12? Paper 140, section 8, which is old single column 1579. You may recall there's that little thing in there in the block about doing the Father's will, where it says, you know, Jesus quoted with approval on this afternoon the old Hebrew saying, "He who will not work shall not eat." Did you notice quoted, okay, but tweaked?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, this is, you know, just the cold, hard, "He who does not work shall not eat." Like, you were injured in an accident and can't work. Well, that's bad luck for you. You're just going to starve to death now. I mean, life is just, you know, a game of chance, and you crapped out. You know, you're going to die. If you're not working, you're not eating, bud. And they were very, you know, slaves to chance and, you know, and cold-hearted like that. You notice there's a truth there, though, Jesus is saying, right? He who will not work shall not eat. That an appropriate element of a mores system or the ethics of a people is that if someone will not work, well, there's an easy way to fix that, either that or remove them appropriately from the gene pool, then they don't get to eat. And we all know how politically incorrect that thought is. Our immature spiritual consciousness wants to reject Jesus's suggestion there for a cultural norm. And it doesn't matter if they will not work, you know, give them free food. See, and that's the basic thing, see. It's, you know, you don't want any notions of free, okay, in the society. If you're going to have something, it needs to be as a consequence of work. You know, in particular, you know, this designed phenomenon of labor, where you have a whole conscious system that you're part of. Yeah.
Well, we passed over. It's the necessity for labor is man's paramount blessing.
Yeah. We haven't passed over yet. I hadn't gotten to it.
Gee, you're a fast trigger.
It's kind of a new thought.
Oh. Yes, and I was going to bring it up just because you go, why didn't they say the more straightforward, the necessity for labor is man's highest blessing? Why did they say paramount? To just stress, it's not merely that it's high, but, you know, the literalness of paramount, that it's an uphill battle. It involves bringing in a human, overruling the natural, and going uphill. Not the path of least resistance. That's downhill. But going uphill, the literalness of uphill in that word. Okay? You know, that they're trying to stress that. The path of least resistance may be the law of matter, but it's not the law of spirit. And see again, this whole bit of to be human is to be unnatural. And that's a simple way to think about what you mean by unnatural. To not be just a phenomenon that's doing that material law thing of following the path of least resistance, but a phenomenon that's going uphill instead of the water that flows downhill. Yeah. And so there... it's all just so delightful when you think about the selection of words. Every word is very precisely selected, you know, to bring as much potential into it as possible. And the more you think about it, the better it gets, if you're thinking well.
You can even use that water flowing downhill to propel something uphill.
Right. See, and that's where you think, oh, yes, but it's really handy that that's an acronym. I could use that. You know? I could put a little wheel with paddles, you know, in the midst of that water. And right.
You could design it.
I could work that into the design. Yes. Yeah. But nonetheless, recognize as an individual, you're trying to be unnatural. You're trying to go uphill. You don't float up to paradise. You climb up to paradise. And the closer you get, the steeper it gets. Right? The more it takes out of you to get there. Like we so often bring up, you think you've had a steep climb getting to the third circle of Avona. Wait till you get to the second and first circles. Right? What used to appear to be vertical now appears to be horizontal. Right?
Sure, glad we get lots of help.
Yeah, and remember, by the time you're there, you love it, you know? It's like, bring it on, you know? That's not vertical enough for me.
That all you got?
But that's not how we start. We start the exact opposite of that. See, we're as far from the doorway to paradise as you can get. Okay.
That feast and fast.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's right. Yep. Okay, let's see. I think we got everything, except just maybe just stressing once again and before we go on that, to notice how Buddhism descended in quality. See, and Buddha became. I didn't start out that way, it's become very muddled over time. Remember, they even use the word grotesque. So, anyway, again, it's like, well, why is it grotesque? Well, it's because it's not. It's just so natural and animal in what it's about. It's not. It doesn't have that uphill human aspect to it. Where's the effort, struggle, conflict that then produces the necessity for the exercise of faith? That is, there's no place for faith to function if there isn't conflict. Just seeking the absence of suffering, for instance. If you want to never have any need for faith, go for that. You're just going to, the gravity is going to pull you down. It's just going to be a fancy animal phenomenon that will unfortunately be thought of as the highest spiritual thing conceivable. Okay.
The Sangic tribes were fairly industrious when residing away from the tropics. But there was a long, long struggle between the lazy devotees of magic and the apostles of work, those who exercised foresight.
There's that foresight, see? And just saying apostles of work like that, even. How they're trying to get you to appreciate the differential that's in play there by using such a compelling word like that, as apostles of work, right? There's this human apostolic phenomenon there, and again, we see that whole bit about the salubriousness of the tropics, right? And why humans are programmed to go north away from the tropics, And here they're introducing, it's like, well, how did humans, what kind of a rationalization scheme did they come up with? And see, the basic thing is magic, you know, is how they found a way to exalt their natural laziness, you know, is to bring in the magic, see, and to basically rationalize that, that, you know, God and spirit and everything is all about that magic. And if you want God in your life, see, there has to be a place for magic in your life. So there's a place for God. And so being, you know, lazy and having to depend upon, you know, magic is all the way it should be. See how this rationalization scheme went. Okay, yeah. But, you know, we've got effort, struggle, that there was a long, long struggle. To the point where we finally faced that. You know, at least some people did. All right, a little bit more on foresight here.
The first human foresight was directed toward the preservation of fire, water, and food. But primitive man was a natural-born gambler. He always wanted to get something for nothing, and all too often during these early times, the success which accrued from patient practice was attributed to charms. Magic was slow to give way before foresight, self-denial, and industry.
So as you notice, there was actually that favorable condition of patient practice there, but it's unrecognized. Because it's in the midst of all this magical notion. So, you know, bottom line, you attribute it to the, you know, the effectiveness of, you know, of the charm.
He's lucky.
Yep. And this issue gets dealt with, you know, more later on in the Revelation. In section 1 of paper 86, you know, there's that delightful expression of what they were just talking about there. This is bottom of single column, page 950, where it says, primitive man alternated between two potent interests, the passion of getting something for nothing and the fear of getting nothing for something. And this gamble of existence was the main interest and the supreme fascination of the early savage mind.
Mind. I see this stuff all the time.
Yeah, it's sad to record that's not as ancient as it appears in that sentence. Yes.
As early as yesterday.
Yeah, as early as this afternoon.
Supreme fascination.
Yeah, see that supreme fascination. Like I said, see, this whole thing gets exalted into the whole, you know, is equivalent to God and spirit and everything. See? There isn't anything higher than all these magical notions. And it's the exaltation of the animal, but it doesn't appear that way because there's this whole magic thing. It's, you know, there's no reality to that. You know, so you take away the imaginary, and all you have is this exaltation of the animal and the lack of human quality of consciousness and effort. Yeah, so that whole bit of the passion of getting something for nothing and the fear of getting nothing for something. The degree to which humans still want to gamble, see, is really the degree that they want to go back to just the fancy animal state with magic being the transcendent element in their life, you know, the God in their life. God is just the magic man.
Lady Luck, God the Mother.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't know how far we can get in section 3, but why don't we get into it a little ways here if we can. we were already hinting at it. Handy to get into it a little bit here.
Section 3, the specialization of labor. The divisions of labor in primitive society were determined first by natural and then by social circumstances. The early order of specialization in labor was.
Okay, just to note, see, they want you to think about the contrast between what's a natural circumstance and what's a social circumstance. If that isn't obvious what the distinction is, it will be as you go forward. The natural one, Gene was already recognizing, there's males and females.
One, specialization based on sex. Women's work was derived from the selective presence of the child. Women naturally love babies more than men do. Thus, woman became the routine worker, while man became the hunter and fighter, engaging in accentuated periods of work and rest.
Okay, so they're pointing out that the fundamental fact that produces this differentiation relative to labor is that woman has maternal instinct, but man doesn't have paternal instinct. You see there. Yeah, women naturally love babies more than men. Men do. Why? Because man doesn't have a paternal instinct. Okay. I mean, all you have is the higher, subtler parental instinct. Okay. However, notice that so that's what creates this differentiation, but it immediately has some appropriateness with the place direction differential. Coincidentally, woman finds herself in a more place-like mode, and man finds himself in a more direction-like mode. It's like, but it was the sex hunger maternal instinct thing that's initiated the differentiation, but kind of what maintains it there is a seemingly appropriate, comfortable estate for both is place direction differential. So the woman is the routine worker in the place, and then man is this directional phenomenon, and only goes zooming on a direction for so long. It's like, okay, I'm exhausted, So you've got this contrast of work and rest.
And a woman's work is never
done. Yes, exactly. Right? There's few things older than that, adage, because of this fact.
Because he's going to get tired and he needs a place to rest.
And coincidentally, she supplies the place that he can rest. Yeah.
Just make sure you come back to this place.
He's at the watering hole again.
All right, what else do they say here?
All down through the ages, the taboos have operated to keep woman strictly in her own field. Man has most selfishly chosen the more agreeable work, leaving the routine drudgery to woman. Man has always been ashamed to do woman's work, but woman has never shown any reluctance to doing man's work. But, strange to record, both men and women have always worked together in building and furnishing the home.
Okay, so two basic elements there in the whole big first part of that paragraph. Trying to help us with, man has most selfishly chosen, But notice that what they're trying to explain is, an perhaps unrecognized element there. It's this taboo thing that men are subjecting themselves to. They don't even recognize this. That women aren't. Just the power of that ancient taboo that's still ongoing that man has always been ashamed to do woman's work. See, it's not just a Maury thing, it's a taboo. If it's going to be always like that, it's got to be very strong. It's got to be a taboo, like they pointed out there. For a man to recognize that, like, whoa, so I'm just unwittingly submitting myself to this ancient taboo? why am I doing that? You know, it's like they explain, you know, later on in the book that jealousy appears to be genetic, you know. It's like, no, it's not genetic at all. That's just something we impose upon ourselves. It isn't, you know, something that naturally is instinctually there at all. And, you know, no matter how much it seems like you have no control over this, and, you know, there's a lot of things like that that we just don't appreciate because they're so ancient and so, you know, so shrouded in, you know, in the mystery of time that we just unwittingly are still submitting to them. It's a part of that reflective thinking to plunge all the way to the depths of this framework that you live in and see it for its unnecessary nature, if that's appropriate. You know, this doesn't have to be the framework that I function in. I don't have to feel ashamed. It's not genetic. I'm imposing this on myself, this shame. It's not because I have the chemistry that a guy has. It's not where it's coming from. Right? So that's, you know, that can be very illuminating to appreciate that. You can do something about that. Just liberate yourself from that bondage. Now, but strange to record. Okay, go. So yeah, that is strange because boy, that foundational differential, where sex hunger on one side and maternal instinct on the other side. Why have men and women always worked together?
She needed somebody with a screwdriver to put up the curtain.
You know, what's the answer? We've already talked about it. What do they share both in quantity and quality in common? Parental instinct. Yeah. All right.
It must be
building and furnishing the home, right? The commonness of the parental instinct makes that happen, despite... right, the individual thing of sex hunger on one side and maternal instinct on the other. Okay,
so the guy's coming over for the game. We're going to do that later.
We all know that other things intervene. But just, I mean, one of the things that can eat at that very natural common foundation is... the desire for self-gratification, that pleasure stuff, right? See, more and more we're overruling these foundational elements with the desire for pleasure. And the home breaks down. Okay? So that one's, you know, has a lot of natural as well. As this next one.
2, modification consequent upon age and disease. These differences determined the next division of labor. The old men and cripples were early set to work making tools and weapons. They were later assigned to building irrigation works.
So, you know, remember how we saw there was some initial tendency. It's like, well, you know, that there's a deformity there or something, just kill it. You know, but a little bit of insight, it's like, wait a minute, no, don't kill them just because they're crippled. We could use them. They have a place. You start to think in terms of a system. You know, it's like if they could work in that part of the system, and you know, we can work in this part of the system. So you're starting to get a little bit more of a human quality. And recognizing that you can work with the physical and mental differences. You don't have to somehow desire or totalitarianly impose some sort of physical or mental, you know, similarity. Okay, so that's an important element. You know, it seems like it's just a factual statement, but you know, but think about it. You know, there's a sophistication there. You're recognizing, let's work with this. This is not just a negative as it appears. There's a positive potential here, despite the negative actuality. Okay.
3, differentiation based on religion. The medicine men were the first human beings to be exempted from physical toil. They were the pioneer professional class. The Smiths were a small group who competed with the medicine men as magicians. Their skill in working with metals made the people afraid of them. The white Smiths and the black Smiths gave origin to the early beliefs in white and black magic, and this belief later became involved in the superstition of good and bad ghosts, good and bad spirits.
So, again, they're giving a little help about how naturally you had this evolution into the dual spiritism model. It starts with, you got the tin smiths on the one hand and the iron smiths on the other hand. And you know, and that suggests, because everything is all magical, you know, and it's very kind of scary and mysterious, you know, hot metal. Remember the whole bit with the prince's staff, you know, and working with hot metal and stuff, right? That it ends up not just being white metal and black metal, but, you know, white magic and black magic, you know, and that carries over into the whole notion of ghosts, that when people die, they don't just disappear, they become ghosts, and so you have good and bad ghosts, and then eventually, like they're saying, you have it just these spirit beings that have nothing to do with having been formerly been material, you know, mortal creatures. And you've got the full-on dual spiritism model. But it starts with the simple fact that some metals are light colored, some metals are dark colored, and you know, that played a huge role. And then this whole magic thing and this battle between the two flavors of magicians, you know, you can see that you've got on the one hand sort of scientific magicians and religious magicians, and this tension between science and religion, you know, in this very primitive form gets started. Right, but it's magic on both sides. And see, we've come all the way around again, you know. You've got the scientists, you know, back in the magic state again, and the religionists have hardly left it from medicine man beginnings. See, and they'll bring that up here.
Smiths were the first non-religious group to enjoy special privileges. They were regarded as neutrals during war, and this extra leisure led to their becoming, as a class, the politicians of primitive society. But through gross abuse of these privileges, the Smiths became universally hated, and the medicine men lost no time in fostering hatred for their competitors. In this first contest between science and religion, religion, or superstition, won. After being driven out of the villages, the Smiths maintained the first inns, public lodging houses, on the outskirts of the settlements.
Very bizarre path, but the end result is kind of handy. Yeah, so you know, see, between the lines, there's this delightful way that evolution works. Through all of this ignorance and superstition and whatnot, very handy things result nonetheless, because it's all a vast conspiracy, right?
The Smiths didn't just disappear because there was a utility there.
Yeah.
They were needed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Even if they didn't go on to a different profession, like just being an innkeeper, you know, you still would have the Smith in the outskirts of the town, you know, and your first thought is, well, you know, it's all kind of messy and stuff. You don't want it right downtown. No, there's more to it than that. Keep those evil magicians off in the outskirts of town. Besides that, they're always, you know, conniving and scheming. Lots of things that you can recognize, you know, about why it came to be the way it is there. Okay.
4, master and slave. The next differentiation of labor grew out of the relations of the conqueror to the conquered, and that meant the beginning of human slavery.
Short little statement, because of course we're going to get into extensively into the whole issue of slavery, but you can see how, as we, you know, these last two, we've gotten into a, you know, an awful lot of what they called social circumstances up front there, not just natural circumstances, right, that are producing this differentiation of labor. Okay, what else?
5, differentiation based on diverse physical and mental endowments. Further divisions of labor were favored by the inherent differences in men. All human beings are not born equal.
So, you notice how they purposely constructed that sentence to be as definitively in contrast to all men are born equal as they can make it. All human beings are not born equal. And, you know, I stress that all the time. See, they gave it basically a whole little paragraph to itself. It's just so huge, that fallacy. You know, there are physical and mental differences. Yes, we're spiritually equal, but we are physically and mentally different, and the whole point is to not have wishful thinking about some magical equality, but to find an equity for society. You know, like we're thinking about with the aged and the diseased there. Right there, to harmonize the physical and mental differences predicated on spiritual equality. That's an equity. The harmonization of physical and mental differences predicated on spiritual equality is equity.
Doesn't say not born useful.
Right. Yeah. Okay, keep going.
The early specialists in industry were the flint flakers and the stonemasons. Next came the smiths. Subsequently, group specialization developed. Whole families and clans dedicated themselves to certain sorts of labor. The origin of one of the earliest castes of priests, apart from the tribal medicine men, was due to the superstitious exaltation of a family of expert sword makers.
See, there again, you see that, you know, magic equals the whole spiritual God domain. You know, and so it doesn't matter if you're a medicine man magician or a smith magician, you can get this exalted position in society. You know, we all know all of the mythologies about magical sword makers. Right? And it's just, you know, it's not because you've imposed that artificially on the story. No, I mean, smiths were believed to be magicians, yeah, magical workers. Okay.
The first group specialists in industry were rock salt exporters and potters. Women made the plain pottery and men the fancy. Among some tribes, sewing and weaving were done by women, and others by the men.
Okay, so with sewing and weaving, that one, you know, either way, you notice the plain pottery, fancy pottery, you think, well, boy, that sounds a lot like the plain bird, the fancy bird. Remember how they often pick things up from nature, you know, and they notice that the fancy animal is, you know, is the male, you know, and the plain one is the female. You know, so things like that, you know, can be the source of some of these differentials. It's not just some sort of a, you know, simple male-female bias thing like we might interpret it to be. And you see just like in both of these, you know, it starts out very fundamental. You know, flint makers, you know, like the very first things that Anna and Fonta were doing, like, for instance, you know.
Flint Flakers.
Yeah, Flint Flakers, yes. The Flint Flakers and the stonemasons, you know, and then, you know, when you get metalworking and, you know, subsequent, you got the smiths. And, you know, here you see the same thing, something very rudimentary, like, you know, the need for salt. You know, so it always starts in that very immediate, most approachable and physiologically needed elements. Okay.
The early traders were women. They were employed as spies, carrying on commerce as a sideline. Presently, trade expanded, the women acting as intermediaries, jobbers. Then came the merchant class, charging a commission, profit, for their services. Growth of group barter developed into commerce, and following the exchange of commodities came the exchange of skilled labor.
Okay, so that's the paragraph that obviously leads into where we'll be next time. In getting into trade. But let's notice some of the elements there. So the early traders were women. Yeah, you may not have known that, but they explain how that came to be. It's because women were employed as spies. It's like, I wonder why women were effective spies. Could it have something to do with... the charms, and that sex hunger thing.
And susceptibilities.
Yes. But see, notice, you're like, well, that's all pretty debased, you know. Yes, but look it, right? And as long as she's out and about, you know, getting this intel, yeah. Let's get commerce starting. It's, you know, it's someone that's needing to go far afield and not staying in the shire, right? going far afield, and so you start to get, you know, transportation and trade going. Yeah. So those, again, you know, it all seems in and of themselves, you know, very crude. You know, the whole sex hunger thing and you know, and women with their fishing lures and curves and stuff, but it primes the pump, pardon the pun, and gets things going. Right?
Well, they probably weren't armed either. Yeah. Men typically went around armed.
Yeah.
She probably had her ways, though. She probably didn't need to be armed so much.
Right, but
no, she wasn't a threat.
Right, but we'll see that thought is exactly what they bring up. In the next section, let me bring up that whole bit about, you know, the relationship between weapons and trade, right? And how she would not, because she isn't carrying the weapons, she has weapons, you know, that she's using for the spying that she possesses on her own accord.
Don't see it.
but the fact that she doesn't literally have, spears and swords and clubs or whatnot. That feeds into the whole getting the trade thing started. Yeah, so we'll see that. So all this stuff is just this delightful dance of what's just there, very basically and natural. How it seems like a limited actuality, but it's this vast potentiality. All these things are good in the way they play into the system. You know, and it's only when they're taken to inappropriate extremes that they become bad. The sexual attraction between men and women is put there by God. It's not an evil fact. All right, so like I said, we'll get going on commerce and trade and stuff next time here. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.